You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. We are joined today by Joe Whipple, who is the Director of Graduate Studies and Professor of the Practice of International Relations at the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies. He is also a former CIA officer who spent a 30-year career as an operations officer in the National Clandestine Service, although at the time, he's probably the Director of Operations. Whipple has served overseas as an operations officer and operations manager in Bonn, West Germany. For the kids out there, there used to be a country called West Germany. Guatemala City, Luxembourg, Madrid, Spain, Mexico City, Vienna, Austria, and Berlin, Germany, where he was the station chief. On assignments in CIA headquarters, he served as a deputy chief of human resources, as a senior NCS representative to the Aldrich Ames Damage Assessment Team, as chief of Europe Division, and as the CIA's director of congressional affairs. Whipple has coordinated extensively with other members of the U.S. intelligence community, and prior to his arrival at Boston University in 2006, he occupied the Richard Helms Chair for Intelligence Collection in the NCS training program. His areas of expertise include security and intelligence, terrorism, and ISIS. Joe, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at the International Spy Museum.
Thank you.
So whenever we have a former practitioner, I like to ask the question about their recruitment. Because a lot of our audience are young people, high school, college students who are thinking about a career in intelligence. And now with so many different agencies, with so much going on in the world of intelligence, they're wondering, how do I get in? How do I become involved in this? What is the right job for me? So can you talk a little bit about how you got into the CIA?
I was studying to become an academic in modern European history, and had a fellowship to go overseas. And this fellowship was in Germany, and I think during that year I came to realize that an academic life isn't what I really wanted. I wanted more of an international life. I had always been interested in international affairs and politics, and so I came back to the University of Minnesota recruiter where I was studying at the time. And he suggested, you know, the State Department exam, the Department of Defense, international banking, and by the way, here's the telephone number of the CIA recruiter in St. Paul. And that's what started it. And I think a lot of life is shooting a dart at a dartboard. But I made an unknowing but great decision for my life, because I really enjoyed my career in CIA.
And a lot of people today, it's very different today than it was when you were recruited, as far as the number of people who are trying to get into a job at CIA. But often we tell people here at the museum, getting into CIA is like getting into a Ivy League school. Is everyone who applies is very, very smart. Everyone has some kind of background that makes them unique. What do you think attracted the CIA to you? Like, what can you give as advice for young people thinking about a career in the CIA to try to make them more, you know, appealing to the agency?
Well, I think one thing that attracted them to me was age. I was over 25. I think they like to, both they and State Department likes to recruit people between 25 and 35. I think fluency in a language. I was very fluent in German language, That certainly is true today, too, if you've got real fluency in just about any language. I mean, the flavors of the day are Chinese and Arabic and Persian and Dari. But if you're really a fluent Spanish speaker, that's going to help you. I think, you know, having a master's degree, having lived overseas, having had experience overseas, I think anybody who can bring other skills to the table, including knowledge of international relations, but it can be computer science, it can be, you know, the sciences and some physics, biochemistry, those type of things. Anybody that can combine these things. And then just plain old experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had a student come to me and say, well, should I take this internship or should I work in my father's business? I work in your father's business, right. You know, so that you really learn something. And then I think it's just personality traits. You know, good old patriotism, a wish to serve, I think is also important for someone applying to CIA.
You're actually one of our rare podcast guests whose career extended through three different transitional periods. A lot of times our guests will have retired before the end of the Cold War, before 9/11, or they're relatively young mm-hmm. CIA agents who started after 9/11. Your career actually expands pre the end of the Cold War into that 1990s period of uncertainty, and then, of course, post 9/11. Can we talk a little bit about those very important transitional periods? How did the end of the Cold War hit you as a CIA operations officer, especially in Germany, right? Somebody that was German.
Well, I was in Madrid when the wall came down. I was incredibly happy about the end of that era and the end of the Cold War, simply because of the danger of having 30,000 nuclear weapons on both sides. And I felt subsequently that would be, a really great era of intelligence collection, because you're going from a kind of a black and white world or a bifurcated world into a more complex, messy type of world that we're in right now, which is much more interest-driven by, you know, various countries, regions, and national groups, religious groups, and so on and so forth. And, I've always been a little bit skeptical of the American penchant for friends and enemies. I'm not so sure if we have friends or enemies. Mm-hmm. We have interests. Others have interests that they follow. I think intelligence is there to help us define our own interests and understand the interests of others so that, you know, we can move forward. So I think it was easier before the end of the Cold War, although a lot of our intelligence collection wasn't just on the Soviet Union mm-hmm. or on Mao's China. I think it was much more diverse than that. I think, going into the 90s, there was obviously the peace dividend. There were big cuts in intelligence capability, which I think we suffered for after 9/11. And I think subsequent to 9/11, I think, regrettably, the focus has very much been on just a few issues,
right.
Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, somewhat remaining China. But in a lot of areas of the world, I think we have had insufficient focus, especially since, intelligence collection is so much looking 20 years ahead,
right.
10 years ahead, 20 years ahead, 30 years ahead. I mean, if we would want to have intelligence on Iraq in 2003, we should have started 30 years
right.
earlier when they weren't hostile.
Right.
But you look at Iraq, it's in collecting intelligence. You don't collect the intelligence on necessarily, targets that are hostile. You collect it because they're important. They're important to you. And they're not hostile. They're going to be very friendly for that matter.
Well, and is that how you would answer those who criticize American collection today on countries that are allies, that like Germany, for instance? I mean, you are the German expert.
Right.
You know, there was a hubbub a year and a half ago, maybe last year, where apparently we were tapping Angela Merkel's phone, although we weren't, apparently now that there's no evidence of that. But certainly we pay attention to what is happening inside Germany. Is that how you would answer critics of that program?
Well, I would say that's a very interesting question, because it's a pretty complicated question. On the one hand, on a political level, you are asking Germany to carry the water for us on a major trade treaty. Mm-hmm. You're asking Germany to carry the water for us on Ukraine, and essentially is the dominant power in the European Union. So, you probably need some kind of special relationship, different from the one that we have with the United Kingdom, but a special relationship anyway. Now, that's one side of the thing. Right. Now, engaging in human and espionage, you have to do it in a different way in a country like Germany, which might not be the classical, recruitment way. But essentially, perhaps finding sources who, on a confidential way, want to speak to you and tell you what they're thinking without it necessarily getting onto 50 desks in
right.
Washington. So it's and this type of, frankly, to be honest with you, this type of sophistication, I don't know if we're capable of. I mean, if you served in the Third World or, in some other areas of the world where, the recruitment cycle is very easy and, it's easy to make recruitments and, it is very different than, a German, French.
Much more nuanced.
Yep, extremely more nuanced. But I think there is a role for that, mm-hmm. that there are people who want to talk off the record. To the U.S., which is still going to be the dominant power in the world, the reverse can also be true here in Washington when they're diplomats and intelligence officers fan off.
Yeah, back fan channels off. Have been a way
right.
of doing things
right.
for a minute, long, long
right.
time.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk a little bit about your students at Boston University, because actually you're one of the unique former practitioners that is now teaching average everyday people who don't have necessarily a background in intelligence. We face a lot of challenges here at the museum where our guests come from a world where the only thing they know, and I'm putting quotes around that, you don't see that, but there's air quotes in my head, about intelligence is what they've seen in a James Bond movie or Bourne or TV, The Americans, or maybe even what they've read in newspapers and not truly gotten beyond the headlines and understood what it was. I imagine you face a lot of the same challenges dealing with undergraduate students that don't have a background in intelligence.
I think the biggest problem, dealing with undergraduate students and maybe even in a wider scope than that is there's not much concentration on international affairs. I mean, one of the first things I will start each class with is, what is the president probably reading about in his president's daily brief today? Whether that's President Obama or President Bush or whoever it is, so that there isn't that familiarity of things going on. What does the president want to know? I mean, what does he want to know about the positions that the Iranians are taking in the, in the negotiations? What about the internal conflicts in Iran that are going on? And this is something that, you're not going to get in the nightly news, the nightly national news or CNN or anything like that. And so I think that's the real challenge. Mm-hmm. And the challenge that probably you're facing here at the Spy Museum, as well as any, is that in a way we're becoming more isolationist rather than more international
right.
in an era of greater globalization, which I think is very, very ironic. So, it's getting people to concentrate on this. But I'd say, in any weekly edition of the New York Times, three or four or five days of those, there is an article about intelligence.
Yeah, now more than ever.
Exactly.
If you look 10, 15 years ago, the public didn't know anywhere
right.
near, or at least didn't have an idea. The joke back, of course, in the 80s and 90s was NSA was no such agency.
Right.
And no one had heard of it. And certainly even today, you have agencies like NRO that people are starting to learn about for the first
right.
time. And, if you're going to have a well-functioning democracy, you kind of need to have people who are voting that understand some of these issues on a broader level than they do otherwise.
Right.
One of your specialties is terrorism and ISIS. We've had guests before that have had different backgrounds than you do. So I want to kind of get your particular viewpoint on ISIS. And I've heard the answer to this question in very different ways. How is ISIS different? How are they? Why are they not Al Qaeda writ large? What is? do we have to treat them a different way? Because I know you've given interviews on this. I know you've talked about this in the press.
I'm not sure I would call myself an expert on this. You know, I probably have as good an opinion as you do. I think probably the difference might be that they have a much more sophisticated program. I mean, they actually are somewhat proficient at establishing a government. You know, somebody that makes sure that the electricity works, that the water is running. And then they have a very sophisticated recruitment program and a strong ideological component to that. I think too radical for it to really stay there forever. I mean, I think there's going to be a point in time when, you know, people are just broken by that type of system and will react against it and won't cooperate, and it'll create more enemies that will eventually destroy them if they don't destroy themselves first. Yeah. So that's my opinion. But when you say expert on that, I got to beg.
Well, there is a level of expertise that you have that I do want to tackle here with as far as ISIS is concerned, and that's the role of intelligence against an organization like this. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be ISIS specifically. I mean, beyond covert action, which is the obvious, right? Go kill them where they are. What is the role of human intelligence, imagery intelligence, signal intelligence when you're dealing with a non-state actor, someone, we're no longer in this world where it's let's study the Russians, let's study the Chinese. You have potential issues with leadership. You don't know who they are. You don't know where they are. How do we fight this war through the intelligence prism?
I think in some ways it's somewhat traditional, except for the fact that you really have to be looking ahead. I mean, some people were surprised by the Arab Spring, but I really wasn't surprised. Now, I didn't know when it was going to happen, but I think also believed always that these family businesses couldn't go on forever. So you have to be prepared for surprises, even if you don't know what that surprise is going to be. But there are a lot of different ways, to penetrate these organizations. To try and influence these organizations and to understand these organizations, and I think in this regard, and almost any other intelligence area, there simply is no substitute for expertise on them. To hire people and to train people and to maintain people in their expertise on these various organizations. I don't think Americans like expertise, especially the political class doesn't like expertise. Somebody coming to them saying, "Sorry, Mr. President, sorry, Secretary, this isn't going to work," you know.
Right.
And so I think there's get as much expertise on SIGINT, HUMINT, IMINT that you possibly can. Always looking ahead for the next thing that could happen. Because there's some of those things that I think a lot of these governments in the Middle East, Africa as well, they just can't go on forever.
Right. All right. We are the most technically proficient country the world has ever seen. Are we relying too much on the technical collection aspects? Are we going too far away from the old-fashioned human intelligence? Particularly, forget the Middle East. Forget terrorism.
Right.
Worldwide, dealing with Russia, China, everywhere else, are we relying too much on satellites and the NSA? Are we going away from the old-fashioned, tried-and-true way of doing espionage?
I believe in espionage. And, again, but I also believe in, signal intelligence and imagery intelligence. I don't know how you can, frustrate the efforts of terrorists without getting into their communications networks. But for a deeper understanding of the world, I believe that intelligence collection through HUMINT is absolutely essential. And the areas that I saw it in my career where we had the most influence essentially was when our reporting and State Department reporting were basically saying the same thing, coming in different maybe coming at it from different angles, but actually changing U.S. policy through knowledge and understanding. So I believe very strongly in that.
Let's shift gears a little bit. It was one of your career moments was being part of the Aldrich Ames damage assessment team. And for anyone who's been to the Spy Museum, we highlight Ames here. We have his mailbox that he used to signal his Soviet handler. And certainly It's neck and neck between him and Robert Hansen as the most damaging spy in American history. And you were on the team that determined the kind of the damage that Ames did. And I want to ask you a little bit about that, because the Ames the document that came out, the report, said that Ames caused more damage to the United States, the national security of the United States, than any spy in the history of CIA. Now there is that
the Rosenbergs, CIA, and the right. atomic spies after the war. Yeah. Yeah.
So what was it like to be on that committee, and do you put Ames up there with the worst of the worst?
He certainly belongs in the Spies Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And he essentially compromised all our agents in the Soviet Union. It led to the death of 10 or 12. I don't know the exact number anymore. He compromised a lot. And I think the other thing that's often forgotten, he compromised them just before the collapse mm-hmm. of the Soviet Union. And some of those people might have been really helpful to us mm-hmm. in explaining what was going on and why it was going on and so on. So he did a tremendous amount of damage. So that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that this is part of the intelligence business, that every so often there's going to be that 0.00001% of people who will go and spy for someone else. And I also believe that we don't catch them all, that there's a few people down in Florida, you know, getting their pension checks who actually engaged in espionage on behalf of someone else. But, yeah, he was a very, very destructive spy and a just a terrific source for the Soviet Union and then later Russia.
The assessment of him had some pretty harsh things to say about the CIA. Do you look at Ames as it's just going to happen eventually, statistics say you're going to have somebody like that, or do you see Ames as some kind of indication of some fundamental problem within CIA in the 1980s and 1990s?
No, I don't. I mean, I think his career, beginning in 1967 when he joined, all the way up until 1981, was going along in a normal fashion. I mean, in 1981, he was actually ranked 13 out of 111 in his grade. And then I think things began to fall apart for him. He met his second wife, and she had needs, very strong material mm-hmm. needs. And I think at that time he found that the way he could, satisfy these needs, especially material needs, was to engage in espionage against CIA. I think you can do as much as you possibly can, and in the investigative process and so on and so forth. But that is just one of those things that is part of intelligence, and hardly any intelligence organization, hasn't been penetrated at one time or the other. During that, it was really an interesting time. I could talk about this for the next hour, but there was all this business about everybody. He was a terrible officer, for everyone to see. You could see that he was incapable. He was a boozer, and so on and so forth. But a lot of that simply isn't true. Mm-hmm. And he actually had a lot of friends in the agency, because he cultivated his friendships. Not for intelligence collection, really, but just because they were friendly. So I think a person like that is literally impossible to avoid. I think the major lessons you learn from that is that I think when those people started disappearing, what they probably could have done is had a more concentrated group at an earlier stage looking at this thing. Mm-hmm. And that might have given them an indication that there was something going on. The other issue, of course, it seems, and I'm not sure of my information on this, that at some time or other there was also one of our penetrations of the Russian service, which gave us indications of a high-level asset of theirs in CIA. So it's a this counterintelligence stuff is really interesting. I mean, you know, people say, how could he work for 9 years? You know, well, Robert Hansen, I think, voted and worked for about 20 years, Johnny Walker for 20 years. And if your agent is safe, it's really hard to catch him.
Yeah, there's a lot of hindsight Monday morning quarterbacking about all these cases. Yeah. How did you miss that? Well,
you're right.
It's easy to see now.
Yeah, right? And you know, you probably didn't. And like I say, if your agent is secure, it's very hard to catch him.
It really comes down to if they don't make mistakes.
Right.
You know, the only way you're going to catch them is if they do something dumb. Or
if you have a penetration.
Right.
Mean, the way to catch a spy is with a spy. It's a very good book in German called Headquarters Germany, in which, you know, these two MFS guys, East German spies, say, you know, writing about CIA, and they say, well, we had a lot of these people doubled, and we knew what was going on. But there was one we just didn't know about, and we knew who the case officer was, and we couldn't catch him. Well, that's because they didn't know about him. Simple as that.
Yeah. Toward the end of your career, we talked about this in the introduction, you were the Richard Helms Chair for Intelligence Collection at the NCS Training Program. So let's talk a little bit about training. Is it better than it once was? Is it worse? Is it different? You can only say so much, of course, because, you know, training officers is somewhat hush-hush. But what do you think it's necessary? Say you were planning the curriculum for training future operations officers 10 years from now, 15 years from now. What do you think is necessary for the future CIA, a generation from now, perhaps, that's different than when you went through training?
I think.
I know I'm putting you on
the
spot.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's an interesting and good question. I think, first of all, we train them a lot. They spend a lot of time in training. You know, a decade or so ago, I was talking to one of my British colleagues, and I asked, how much time do you spend in training? And they said, well, you know, 5 months, so we're trying to get it down to four. And our biggest problem is, you know, the pitch. You know, how do you make a recruitment approach and so on? And I'm thinking, you know, gosh, we have just tons more of training. I think probably the best training is going out to the field and having a good mentor, an experienced officer, to help you learn what you're supposed to do. But I think beyond that, other than the good old-fashioned learning tradecraft is, I think, really important. I mean, really, really important. But then bringing those other skills to bear, you know, having good language, having good knowledge of the culture that you're in, being there a long period of time, and having the personal characteristics that will make you a success, that will result in successful espionage.
Is there a problem in the general sense? Again, this might be leaning toward possible security issues. Is there an issue with rotating people out of stations once they finally got their feet on the ground? I mean, the idea of this is a good agent, he's overseas, he's doing a good job, let's bring him back to headquarters and prepare him for something else, or let's move him somewhere else. You know, I'm trying to say this without saying anything I shouldn't say, but you talked about area knowledge. I mean, even your bio. Let's go to your bio. You were lots of different places. Would it have been more beneficial to stick you somewhere for 10 years and just get unbelievably knowledgeable about that area, about that environment, versus bouncing you around?
I think that's a general situation in the U.S. government and in our international relations and in our national security institutions. It's not just you know, CIA. It's the Department of State. It's the military. I mean, if this had been World War II, Eisenhower would have been replaced about four or five times within that 4 year period. So I believe very strongly in knowledge and expertise. The criticism often is that is someone will go native on you,
right.
And well, that's a management issue. That's not a substantive type of issue. So I believe time, skills, language are really, really essential in engaging in successful espionage.
You also had a part of your career where you managed congressional relations for CIA. And we constantly try to reinforce the idea that dissemination is as important as collection and analysis. The idea you could have the best intelligence agency in the world, you could have the smartest analyst, but if you can't convince policymakers of what the information means, of what they should be thinking about doing, you might as well have no CIA at all. In your time there, can you talk a little bit about your experiences dealing with members of Congress, with the committees, and how did that shape your worldview on government? Being as nice as you possibly can, how did that shape your view on the relationship between intelligence agencies and Congress?
I believe that in general, across the board, Congress is very supportive of intelligence. And also, I think the most interesting thing often enough is that the difference between an open session and a closed mm-hmm. session. In an open session, you know, both sides tend to try to make, political points.
Right.
And in a closed session, that really doesn't take place. I mean, they tend to get right to the subject matter. In general, their representatives and senators are as well as informed as you can expect them to be. I mean, they often come from, they can be some, attorney in,
right.
Somewhere in rural Tennessee or a business person. And, but they are all, they tend to be very studious, and I think they do try their best. Often enough, I think a problem is that they don't have the background in intelligence that, you had some people like, Senators Lugar, Biden, Kerry, who really became experts in foreign affairs. And until very recently, you didn't have these type of people on the intelligence committees for an extended period of time.
Right.
That's changing.
Right.
I mean, Senator Coates has been on there quite a long period of time, both the first time he was a senator and now Mrs. Senator Feinstein from California. She's been there.
Yeah.
So they get a certain amount of expertise, which is very helpful. But if you have a good idea, generally they will support you. They don't like being surprised, obviously, although sometimes I think that's a little overdone. Sometimes surprise is surprise. You can't do anything about it. But I really enjoyed, working as Director of Congressional Affairs. I loved having congressmen and senators coming overseas because you had more time with them.
Right.
And you had more time to explain your operational environment. And they're a lot more relaxed. On only a couple of occasions in my 35-year career, one or two where I would say, they were not serious when they were overseas. I mean, they were almost always serious in trying to learn as much as they possibly could.
And I think Codell's congressional delegations, what we were talking about, are somewhat misunderstood by the average taxpayers. Like, they're spending all this money to go over some random place, but that's really the time when members of Congress can get away from their staffs, can get away from their constituents, no offense guys back at home, and really hunker down with the experts in the field. And I think it makes a big difference.
I couldn't agree with you more. And like I say, most of these people have been very good listeners, ask excellent questions. Some of the people like Mrs. Pelosi and Senator McConnell that I've both seen overseas, there's really excellent people as far as being knowledgeable about foreign affairs.
So one final question, and it might take a little while, because I think it's a key component. If you Google Joe Whipple, and hit space and let it fill in that next word, you'll see the word curveball pop up in many cases. And this is in reference to the code name for a agent in place or a information source leading up to the war in Iraq in 2002-2003. And depending on what you read, you'll get about five different versions of the Joe Whipple curveball relationship. So we're actually going to let you talk about it and let the listener know what really happened from your perspective.
Yes, I think probably the best description, that's pretty much it, 90% right, is in Director George Tenet's book on, basically his autobiography on his time in the agency. Curveball was a German intelligence source reporting on mobile biological chemical warfare labs. I think the reporting went through the Defense Human Service, if my memory is correct, and came up after 9/11. And essentially, as noted, the request was to have access to Kerbholm, which the Germans said we could not have. And their assessment of him essentially was that, you know, well, this is his reporting, but we cannot corroborate it with anyone, and that includes other intelligence agencies, international intelligence agencies, as well as intelligence agencies in the region. And that's essentially the warning that I sent in, that, you know, to use an uncooperated source could be dangerous, you know, and so on. And I think, you know, he was the source used on, you know, chemical and biological weapons. I think there was a British source on yellow cake, the right. Italian source on the tubes, a Libby on the Saddam Hussein connection with Al-Qaeda. Right. You know, and they, you know, it's, you know, just, and none of them were corroborated, and right. none of them were our sources. They were always, they were someone else's. So I think it was you know, pretty flimsy to base an argument for weapons of mass destruction based on those sources, including Kerfball.
Right. I don't want to make you assign blame or anything like that. Where does that? How does something like that fall apart? What I mean by that is, you said don't trust the guy. You said this is uncooperated evidence. The Germans are telling us is uncooperated. You sent that up to your bosses, which I assume was sent up to the National Security Council, which finally made its way to whoever was right.
I don't know.
You can't see this. You're shrugging your shoulders. Of course, you don't know where it goes from there. That's that dissemination question, I think, that we were talking about with Congress. I mean, this is a pretty big deal. I mean, it's not the only thing that got us into the war in Iraq, but it certainly was something that people now are looking back and saying, that Kerbal thing. And so there are people, again, if you Google you, they're saying that you were the one that tried to warn everybody, that don't listen to this guy. He's not somebody you want to listen to. There are others saying other things. But again, the idea of how does this fall apart? How do you... And not just for Iraq. Let's talk about in general. Let's be, you know, in general, where there are these, is it hindsight where we're going back and saying, well, duh, like we should have seen it coming? Or was it a collapse in the process that led us to these conclusions?
Or was it basically a political decision
okay.
to go to war? And that's, I think that's what it basically was.
There is no better way to end this podcast. So, Joe Whipple, I really appreciate the time you've taken here to talk to us at the International Spy Museum. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we will see you next month.